What do you think you'd be doing now if you weren't writing?
Well, I think I'd probably be doing much of the same thing that I am doing now, which is fishing guiding in the summers, especially. I think the one thing writing has afforded me is the ability to not find a winter job, which is quite nice. So I used to do construction before this. So I would probably be fishing guiding and working construction.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with fishing guide and author Callan Wink about his debut collection of short stories, Dog Run Moon. We'll begin by talking about Callan's early success and the pressures associated with his sophomore release. This program contains adult language and themes. Listener discretion is advised. When did you know you could write, like, really write?
I don't know that I even know that at this point, but, you know, I started writing these really bad poems from a pretty young age, and probably there are still some of those in my parents' basement that hopefully never come to light.
Do you remember some of the themes of those poems?
A lot of themes about fishing and being outside. I met my fourth grade teacher about 3 years ago at my mother's funeral, and she came up to me and she said, you know, when you were in fourth grade, you wrote this essay that said you wanted to be a poet and a fisherman, and I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah. Yep. Can I ask you about your name?
Sure. Callan is kind of a Scottish Gaelic name. My family's pretty Scottish. I grew up, my dad was in a bagpipe band. My little sister plays the bagpipes. So we're Scottish. It's a Scottish name. Yeah.
Your debut book is a collection of short stories. Why did you pick that form? Or did the form pick you?
Yeah, I think the form picked me. Like I said, I used to write poetry, and then I realized all of my poems were just short stories I was too lazy to write. So I started turning some of my poems into stories. I'm trying to write a novel, but I have a short attention span.
What's the difference for you between working on a novel than in short stories?
I think a novel is just so much more middle. A short story is a lot of beginning and ending, which I personally enjoy. The middle part is the hard part for me, and that is the bulk of a novel.
It reminds me of this line in your book where you write, "The young and the old seem to be uniquely positioned to take advantage of the opportunities life affords. It's the middle time that's a bit." Does it resonate with you?
Yeah, exactly. I never thought of it, applying it to the writing of a novel, but I think it kind of holds true. Yeah, it's a similar feeling.
Do you feel that way also about, I don't know that I'm going to call you midlife, you were born in 1984, but you feel like you're in the middle stretch?
I feel like I'm hitting my stride a little bit, but yeah, approaching middle, definitely. And it's okay, you know, I maybe the position I'm at now will allow me to write a novel, you know.
What would you consider to be your lucky breaks and your tough breaks?
I've been very lucky. I went to grad school after a few near misses at other things for writing in Wyoming. I had some great teachers there, in particular Brad Watson, a great writer, who's very generous with his time and took an interest in my writing and kind of passed it along basically to his agent. And then I got a story in The New Yorker when I was in grad school, and that kind of changed my life, definitely.
Any tough breaks?
I've been very lucky, actually. So I can't really complain about any of that. I'm in a position now where I can kind of write and do what I want. I will say, you know, I've made sacrifices for that. For instance, I definitely devote most of my time to writing and not to, like, being in a relationship with another human being, you know, or, like, traveling around doing awesome stuff. And mostly up until this point, I've been writing a lot. So
you were recently a speaker at the Beargrass Writing Retreat, which I'm going to call an intimate gathering of writers, agents, publishers, even musicians, that takes place
the end of August in this like rustic ranch north of Missoula. And you were on a panel with Sharma Shields called First Book Celebration, Second Book Shock. What pressures do you face following this book?
Yeah, that panel was great. As much as I would like to say that I don't really feel any pressure, there is some. Basically, my first book, this collection of short stories, not like it's setting any sales records or anything, but it has been, you know, generally well received critically. And so often the response you get from a collection of short stories is, I can't wait for this person's novel, you know, really looking forward to it. I can't wait to see what they can do with the long form. You know, this is like the warm up. The problem is, I think maybe the short story is more my form that I'm just suited to. So the pressure then is trying to follow it up with a different form that, you know, I'm able to at least make as good as this one. But it's difficult because no one expected my first short story to be very good, and they weren't. My first, I don't even know how many short stories were horrible. So now my first novel, people expect it to be good, which is kind of annoying. But it's a good problem to have because people are actually expecting me to write a novel, and they gave me some money for it, which many people would kill to be in that position. So I can't complain.
Sure. I've heard you speak about the resistance, both from readers and publishers, to the short story. Why do you think that is?
I think it basically comes down to, you know, I've given this book to a lot of folks who like to read, aren't really maybe literary people, and they like the stories and they read them. They're like, man, I just wish it would keep going. Yeah. So I think the basic thing is people want to be engulfed in a story. I would like to believe that a good short story can get you that same feeling. But I think people who like to read want to be kind of in this world, all-encompassing world, and they don't want it to end. And 23 pages, often people feel kind of shortchanged, like they just got in there and then it's over. I think that's the basic problem, but
it's like an EP versus an LP.
Yeah, totally.
Where do the worlds in your stories come from?
You know, most of them are at least little pieces of them are things that I've overheard or things that happened to me or happened to someone I know. Or, I mean, I think most writers that write in this kind of genre, they take things, everything's material. Everyone I meet, I always tell them, you know, watch out. Anything you say or do probably end up in a story in some twisted way at some point. But yeah, it's all stuff from my life, really, just in weird. I mean, none of it, I would say most of it, people I know wouldn't even recognize themselves or anything. It's all very much pieces of things that I've come across that I've assembled in weird ways. So,
also, in a similar vein, your diction is something that I've remarked upon. Where do you get your words?
Well, I think, I mean, reading. I grew up a huge reader, never had a TV in the house. So I was kind of a lazy kid, and I would just read indiscriminately. So I think that helped me just in the storytelling process in general. It wasn't like I was reading the classics at a young age. Still haven't read most of the classics, to tell you the truth, but I would just read a lot of stuff. And I think you just get this kind of weird well of words and plot formation and kind of unconscious ability to put together a narrative that comes from just a big backlog of stuff that you've read. So I think that, and also since I did used to write poetry a lot, I mean, I think the tendency with poets is to get an image or a thought or a feeling and then try to express it in a way that's just like slightly askew from how you normally would see it. So I think some of that translates into my short stories as well.
Yeah, there's a lyricism to it for sure. And the prose is also really voicey. It's like every character has its own vernacular. And I was wondering if you ever feel like you are pushing it over the edge. I'm going to give you some examples. Like one of your characters says, I don't beat the bush, so I'm going to get right down to the tacks. And another one says, my give a damn is broke. Do you ever feel like you could go overboard?
Oh, definitely. And I think in some of my earlier stories, I definitely did go overboard. And I see it even in this collection. I wouldn't write some of it now the way that I did when I wrote this, for better or worse, but I do like vernacular. And I think the great thing about being in Montana, being in Livingston where I live, I know just a lot of people that the way they talk is much more heavily tinged with strange pieces of idiom and vernacular than anything I would ever write, probably. So, yeah, actually, often I have to tone down the stuff for the page, because if I actually put it how the people I know speak, half the time it wouldn't come across right. But I'm always listening for a funny little turn of phrase. Mm-hmm. I hang out with all these old fishing guides, and then my clients. I got a lot of people from Texas, and old guys from Texas have a lot of great little things they say. So I'm always on the lookout for those, and I definitely throw them in when needed.
Chris Dombrowski recently called your work Mongrel Stories of the New West. How do you feel about that label?
I like it. Yeah. I think the stories are, set in the New West as it is, and not sure what it means to be a mongrel, but as it applies to a fiction piece. But yeah, I think so. I like it.
So some of the themes in this collection, to me, there's a lot of men in limbo, men running, needy men, beta men, men caught in two places at once, really men trying to figure out, insert air quotes, how to be men. And there's this scene in the story, Runoff, and I'm wondering if you would give us some backstory around it and then read it.
Sure. So the particular story, Runoff, basically concerns a younger man, Dale, who is kind of flailed around and dropped out of college and is living in his dad's basement, kind of trying to figure things out for the summer, and he gets a job shadowing an EMT crew. It's his plan. His new plan is to go and get certified to be an EMT. And he thinks that might be a good career path. He's a little bit unsure whether or not he has kind of the constitution to do the job. But he meets an older woman in town who has two younger sons and kind of starts a relationship with her. So in this particular passage, Dale's new girlfriend, Jeanette, her home is being threatened by rising water from a creek. And he and his father had just helped sandbag around the creek so her basement wouldn't flood. And this is kind of the next morning after that. Dale went back inside and helped Jeanette with the dishes. They went to the porch with a blanket wrapped around them, listening, trying to gauge the depth of the water and the dim broadcast of the moon, not talking much. Eventually, she fell asleep with her head on his chest, her arms and legs twitching occasionally. Dale woke, sun just peeking up over the lilac bushes in the backyard. One of the boys was crying. He could hear it coming through the upstairs window. Jeanette was still sleeping, curled, knees to chest, with her back to him. He waited for a moment for her to wake up, but the boy continued to wail, and she showed no sign of movement. He nudged her, and she groaned and rolled over, her face still under the blanket. "One of the boys is up," he said. She said something, mostly unintelligible, that might have been, "It's your turn." Dale lay there, listening to the boy wail for a few more moments. He slipped from under the blanket and squelched across the soggy, cold lawn in his bare feet. There was a brown scum line on the sandbags marking the high point the creek had reached. Their wall had held. The creek was still rushing, but it had settled back within its banks, running straight and hard and tea-colored. He walked back to the porch, and the lump under the blanket that was Jeanette had not stirred. It was silent, and then another sob from upstairs. Dale deliberated for a moment. He went inside. "They're just kids," he was thinking. "Why are you nervous?" He opened the door to the boy's room, and immediately the crying stopped. They looked at him expectantly, red-faced. "Mom?" one of them said, trying to look around Dale to see if she was back there. "She's still sleeping," Dale said. "Let's let her sleep." They were staring at him. The younger one was looking like he was going to start crying again. "Do you guys like coffee?" Silence. The older one shook his head. I bet your mom doesn't let you have coffee, does she? No? Well, she's asleep, so we can do whatever we want. Let's go. We're going to have to hurry before she wakes up and shuts us down. Dale headed downstairs, not sure if they were going to follow. He was filling the carafe with water when they came into the kitchen, blinking, hair standing on end. It's very important to do this correctly, he said. Come here and watch this. You've got to put 5 scoops of grounds in the filter. Okay, 5. Your mom makes coffee and she puts in 4 on a good day. We're men, right? We want strong coffee. 5 scoops. Got it? Sirius nods. Okay, we need mugs. Lots of cream, lots of sugar. When you get older, you'll drink it black, but this is how you start. That's how my dad used to make mine. You don't want to go right to the hard stuff. They sat at the kitchen island, each with a mug in front of him. Now what? One of them asked. We drink our coffee. We talk about the weather. It stopped raining, one of them said, looking out the window. Yep, Dale said, I think it's going to be a nice day. It's been raining a lot. I like snow better than rain. I like it when it's sunny. You guys are naturals at this, Dale said. Jeanette came in the back door. She had the blanket wrapped around her shoulders and her eyes were puffy. She stopped when she saw them sitting there, Dale, with her 2 boys. He could imagine the way it looked to her, the scene almost the way it should be, 1 note off. If she was jarred by it, she hid it well. Dale made us coffee, one of the boys said, and we're talking about the weather. Jeanette sat down. Girls allowed? I guess. She reached for Dale's mug. I can't believe I slept for so long, she said. Jesus, my back. I'm too old for sleeping on porches. She was squeezing his knee under the counter, smiling at him. We didn't flood, Dale said. I noticed. I'm going to bake your dad a pie or something. My God, this coffee is horrible. Are you boys actually drinking this? It's good, one of them said. Because we're men, said the other.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to Callan Wink read from his collection of short stories, Dog Run Moon. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the second half, Callan and I will discuss the role of sex and gender in the Western writing tradition. As a reminder, listener discretion is advised. Who taught you how to be a man?
My dad at first, and then it's an ongoing process, put it that way. I'm not sure I've got it all figured out yet, but my dad is one person in general that I look to. He's a good man, for sure.
There are 2 statements that your characters make in the book, and I want to pose them to you. The first is, fathers are always the harshest judges. Agree, disagree?
I'd say for a lot of people that that's true. I'm not sure that that's true in my case, but yeah, for my character in that particular story, I would say, yeah, that was true for his reality.
And the second one is, I think women are the only real source of motivation in the world for men.
I think so. That's probably true. Yeah. Directly or indirectly.
Okay. So, Callan, if I were to be hard on this book, which I feel like I can do because the prose is so good, it would be that by the 5th story, I was rolling my eyes at the love and sex scenes. And it seemed to me like that we had been here before and, you know, that every guy had a cheating heart and every woman was willing to put up with a guy with a cheating heart and that the sex scenes were fairly catered to the male gaze, which is frustrating to me because the second half of the book like totally steers away from that. So how much of those scenes do you feel like come from an internal place and how much do you feel like comes from this, maybe a sense that you need to write within a certain tradition?
Probably a mix of both. I mean, the point I was at in writing many of these stories, you know, let's face it, I was in my mid to late 20s, had a cheating heart, you know, still do. So I think that personal aspect of it, I think, you know, most of the men I know, it's something they've struggled with in their life. So to make it any other way, I think, would not be true to my reality. But yeah, I mean, I think in a collection of stories, you do have a duty to try to show your breadth as a writer. And so as a criticism, I would say that's pretty legit because, you know, if I am portraying a certain aspect of my characters in a repetitive manner, that's something I definitely don't want to do. So I would probably agree with your assessment of that. And I think, which is one of the things I did like about my decision to put a longer story at the end, you know, from a female perspective, just to kind of show that I'm more than maybe just a one-trick pony, but hopefully.
And I want to be clear that what I'm not asking for is some kind of squeaky clean, terrible Hollywood version. What I'm asking for is mature and compelling and complicated stories, but also that women have cheating hearts, you know, and that there are some other ways of coloring those scenes. You do, by the end of the book, we hear you write in first person and from a woman's perspective. So what did you know about the need or the experience of stepping into those perspectives?
I think maybe people would like to hear me say that, like, writing a woman's perspective is incredibly different or a lot harder or something, but I don't think it actually is. It's just something I haven't wanted to do much. But I'm actually doing more now because if a reader, such as yourself, was getting a little bit bored with some of the ways things were going, like as a writer, I was probably bored with it a lot before you were, you know what I mean?
Right.
So, I don't want to continue to write the same stories. And so I would say the stories I'm writing now are quite a bit different from these and do kind of factor in some of the things you're talking about, different perspectives, more female perspectives. So they're different in that way, but I would say they're not radically different in tone because that's kind of my tone. It's kind of what I've got to work with. So it is, you know, as you say, there are some women with cheating hearts in some of the stories I'm writing now, but it's not much different, really.
Okay. What is your relationship to the women in your stories?
That's a good question. I think, for instance, the story in here that has the largest kind of female presence is the last one, In Hindsight, which is, some people called it a novella. I would call it more of just a long short story. Lauren is kind of it kind of charts the course of this woman's life. And I think people often, they look at this one, they're like, ah, there he is. He's finally writing from a woman. But if I look at that story and she is probably the most masculine woman you could ever, if I could use that term. And so it like fulfills readers' need to have a woman in there. But for me as a writer, I think maybe some of my male characters actually have more like sensitivity than
yes.
She actually does. But her name's Lauren. So we can, you know, it checks that box, I guess.
Right. Like your first story, Dog Run Moon. I mean, this is a pretty sentimental guy in that story.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree.
Of all the characters in this set of stories, who do you identify with the most?
I mean, that's a hard one because I would say all of them, every character in here, men, women, cat, dog, horse, there's like a small piece of my perception in there. So I don't say any one of them has like a larger percentage or anything like that. So I kind of identify with all of them because they're all my creations.
The Battle of the Little Bighorn is a recurring place in the book. Why?
I've been fishing guiding on the Bighorn for a month or so every year for quite a long time. And so I spent some time down there and just driving around in that part of Montana, which it seems like a part of the state that doesn't get the kind of recognition or attention, you know, that the mountains aren't huge, there's nowhere to ski near there, basically, but it's kind of a stark place. I really like it. And I mean, if you haven't been to the battlefield, it's a haunting place. I think it's like something that's stuck in my head at the time that I was writing a lot of these stories.
So thinking about guiding, I was wondering if taking on fishing as a profession changed your relationship to it.
Yeah, I used to really like going fishing, and I still do. You know, I actually went fishing yesterday, but it's definitely different. Anytime you try to do something for money, it's not much different than my writing now. I used to really just enjoy writing for the sake of writing, writing these poems, writing these stories, having no thought whatsoever about any sort of monetary return on these things. But, you know, anytime the money gets involved, it does change your perception of it. But not always for the worse. I think, for instance, fishing, I've caught, for instance, a lot of 14-inch rainbow trout. You know, that's what we do out here in the Yellowstone River. But if I can get like a, you know, 12-year-old kid to catch one, it's the same experience, but they're having a much better time, and that's actually more fun for me. So I don't know if that translates at all into writing, but I still enjoy fishing vicariously through other people.
And do the two professions complement each other, or do they create tension for you?
Both, I think, because each one kind of makes me look forward to the other one. So after a summer's worth of fishing guiding, in which I don't really write at all, I'm very ready to start writing at the end of that. And vice versa, after a season of fishing guiding, I'm very ready to not be doing that anymore. So each one kind of keeps me fresh.
So there's this interview where you take Tom McGuane fishing. It's his audio interview. And at one point he says, "The American short story is getting radically better than it's ever been, and the novel is getting radically worse than it's ever been." Do you agree with that?
As someone who's writing short stories currently, I would say, hell yeah, I agree with that.
And then there's this other point in the interview where you say, "I'd take a whitefish right about now." And I want to know, what's the writing equivalent of that statement?
Getting published in a small literary journal associated with the university, for which you make $200.
Callan Wink was born in Michigan in 1984. He can be found in Livingston, Montana, where he's a fly fishing guide on the Yellowstone River. He's the recipient of an NEA Creative Writing Fellowship and a Stegner Fellowship at Stanford. His work has been published in The New Yorker, Granta, Men's Journal, and The Best American Short Stories. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.